This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to hear from the third-ranking Democrat in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, and the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, John Kyle. We'll start with Schumer, the senior senator from New York State. He's the vice chair of the Democratic Caucus and heads the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is the political organization responsible for all the Democrat Senate races and is widely credited for the Democrats' success in the November elections, which gave the party control of the Senate. Schumer was elected to the Senate in 1998 after serving 18 years in the House of Representatives. He's written a new book about his party and its future called Positively American, Winning Back the Middle Class Majority, One Family at a Time. Senator Schumer, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me just start with a couple of questions about the war in Iraq. The resolution coming out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee opposing the troop increase is a symbolic resolution. And you've said if that passes, there'll be something with more teeth. What exactly might that be?
Well, that's exactly what we're working on now. Terry, a number of senators have good ideas. Senators Kennedy and Dodd have proposed that any additional troops have to be voted on by Congress. Senator Clinton has proposed, we haven't seen the written language yet, legislation that would say no troops unless certain benchmarks are met. But the bottom line is, everyone says just cut off the money. It's easier said than done for this reason. The way we legislate on appropriations bills are in large amounts, this amount for the Army or this amount for this or this amount for that. We do not say we will fund the 3rd Battalion or we will fund the 6th Battalion. So if we put in a set amount of money, the president, even if it's much lower, for instance, than what he has now, the president still could use the money for an escalation and not use it for other things. The second way to do it is, say, put in a troop cap. Now, that would make more sense. There shall be no more than X amount of troops. But there's a problem there, too. And that is, let's say 500 troops are surrounded in Anbar province and they need to bring troops in from out of the country. You don't want to stop that. And so we are figuring this out. We certainly will ratchet up the pressure dramatically on the president to stop the escalation. No troops have been sent there yet. And this resolution, the military spending resolution, will be before us in about a month. But we have to do it in the right way so it doesn't become just symbolic again.
Why have a symbolic resolution before having a resolution that actually has teeth?
Very simply, two reasons. First, if a large number of Republicans vote for the resolution, which we expect they will, condemning the escalation. Now, they may do it in their words, not our words, but that's fine. I think it's going to really send a shot across the bow to the White House. Bottom line is very simple. This White House is sort of it's isolated from the world. Almost everyone else thinks the escalation's a bad idea. They don't. But if 20 or so of their own senators say this is a bad idea, it may well make a difference. At the very minimum, it's going to strengthen the hand within the White House of those who are opposed to the escalation. But second, and more importantly, is this reason. We will need 60 votes to pass a resolution with teeth because, as you know, the Senate works by way of supermajorities because any one member can filibuster and you need 60 members to cut it off. There are some members, very conservative, who will filibuster any attempt at cutting off the escalation. So to get 60 votes, we need 9 Republican votes. We don't have them yet, and this resolution will build support for doing that.
You voted to give the president the power to go to war in Iraq, and you say that you don't regret it because you believe in giving the commander-in-chief the benefit of the doubt. But do you think that Congress, you know, for those members of Congress who now oppose the troop buildup and think that the war was a mistake, do you think Congress failed to do its job in putting the brakes on the war and in further investigating what the consequences of the war could be? There were plenty of people out there warning about most of the problems that we're now faced with.
You know, hindsight is very easy. There were a significant number of people who voted against, but if you believe in a strong foreign policy, which I do, I just think it's totally misguided. You don't defeat terror by fighting long-term wars against countries like we're doing in Iraq. You tend to believe that when the president, commander-in-chief, particularly after you're attacked, says we're going to do something, that you try to do it. And so in retrospect, yes, the president botched this totally. At the time of the vote, it looked like, as Colin Powell told us, there would be a multilateral force that would threaten Saddam, and he would likely back off. We certainly have to figure out a better way to deal with the War Powers Act and an ongoing escalation. But I don't think, and I know, you know, this is sometimes popular, that Congress can totally tie the hands of the chief executive in the dangerous world in which we live. Now, would I ever, I'm one of the strongest advocates for doing something to cut off this escalation, because I'd never give this president the benefit of the doubt again. He has so botched things. But I do believe, in the dangerous world we're in, you have to give the commander-in-chief some degree of latitude.
So you don't want to give President Bush the benefit of the doubt again. President Bush has been speaking a lot about Iran, and a lot of people are wondering, does he plan on any kind of attack on Iran? And, you know, the New York Times is reporting that Iran is trying to expand its economic and military ties with Iraq. And, you know, the article I'm referring to says that will almost certainly bring Iran into further conflict with American forces who have detained a number of Iranian operatives there in Iraq in recent weeks. Do you think that the president is leading towards some kind of, you know, attack or confrontation with Iran?
I can't tell. It's hard to divine what they really think there. I can tell you this. There will be far more scrutiny, far more skepticism of any kind of aggressive plan that the president puts together, because he has proved not to either be very smart about how to do these things or very trustworthy in terms of what he says will happen in terms of what does happen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. He has a new book. It's called Positively American: Winning Back the Middle Class Majority, One Family at a Time. You say in your book that Republicans won in 2004 with eight words: war in Iraq, cut taxes, no gay marriage. And in 2006, Democrats won on no war in Iraq, no corruption, bad economy. You point out that the Democratic message in 2006 was a counter message. It didn't define what Democrats wanted to do. It defined what they didn't want to do. Do you think that Democrats are in the process of putting together a plan of what they want to do as opposed to just a counter plan defining what they don't want to do?
I worry that we're not, and that is why I wrote the book. I'd been asked to write books in the past. I never did. I'm busy and all of that. I wrote this book almost out of a yearning that my party, given the broad technological changes in society, and for the first time in a generation that the middle class is up for grabs, that we capture them with the government programs that make sense in terms of making their lives better. I believe we have some very strong candidates. In fact, I think our candidate field in 2008 is stronger than the Republicans. But if we don't have a real platform, a platform that will win in 2008 and helps create a generation of Democrats, I think we'll have real trouble in the future.
You say in your book that the Republicans' success was based on the message machine that they created and their ability to choose candidates. Did you try to copy from that in 2006? Let's start with the message machine. Did you try to copy the Republican message machine?
Well, we can't copy it because we don't have the tools. They basically have a network in their pocket. Fox News basically repeats the Republican line, and they started off. And as we say, Daniel Squadron, who helped write the book with me, came up with this great line. They are the starter on the grill, but all the media coals are burning with what Fox News says within a week, Swift Boat being an example. They have right-wing radio. Now, what we have on our side is the blogosphere, which is going to be a more and more potent force. And while there's some right-wing parts to it, it's mainly a more Democratic-leaning group, and they're going to be extremely important to us. Having said that, we did adapt some of their techniques, even though we don't have as strong a means to deliver them. One of them is when they hit you with a negative attack, we had a rule in DSCC, hit them back within 24 hours, answer the attack, don't let it go unanswered. It worked.
Now you say that you knew you wanted to defeat Rick Santorum in Pennsylvania. That was one of the main targets for you when you were running the Senate races. And so you called the Pennsylvania governor, Ed Rendell, who's a Democrat, and asked him who he thought could defeat Santorum. And he said, Bob Casey, but you won't want to use him because he's against abortion. Of course, you went with him anyway, and he defeated Santorum. How did you think through whether to use him or not, since the Democratic Party is largely pro-choice and he's against abortion?
And as am I. I mean, I wrote the Violence Against Women Act and the FACE Act, you know, the Clinic Access Act, which has probably had more effect on keeping abortion available in America than just about any other. It stopped the extremists from blockading clinics and threatening doctors and killing doctors, cut that down by more than 80%. But the bottom line is that Casey, not because he was anti-choice, but just because of who he was the best candidate. He really came from the soil of Pennsylvania. His father had a well-known name. He knew how to talk to middle-class average voters. And we weren't going to let his position against choice stand in the way of choosing a candidate who could win. The overwhelming message I got in 2004, when we had lost five seats, is when are you Democrats going to do things to win already? And that sometimes takes some, you know, some strong and difficult actions. But, well, at least this 2 years, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Even with Bob Casey in the Senate, who is firmly anti-choice, the pro-choice movement is in much better shape. And, in fact, I talked to some of the very, very active women leaders, you know, some of them really who were on the far end, after the election. And I said to them, you know, we might have backed Barbara Hafer, who was the candidate against Santorum. And she might have won. But we would have had to put $12 million into that race. And instead, we were able to take that money, because Casey was so popular and led Santorum by virtually double digits throughout the year and a half, and we would put it into Jim Webb's race. He's pro-choice. His opponent, Allen, was anti-choice. Into Claire McCaskill's race. She's pro-choice. Her opponent was anti-choice. John Tester. He's pro-choice. His opponent was anti-choice. So the overall cause of pro-choice was advanced in a sort of dialectical way, as Marx would put it, by supporting Bob Casey.
You served in the House before serving in the Senate. In fact, you have a very unusual distinction. You were in the House during the impeachment of President Clinton, and then you were in the Senate for his actual trial. What were some of the differences between how the House and the Senate handled the Clinton impeachment, and are those differences things that help you define some of the differences between the House and the Senate?
Yes. The Founding Fathers designed the Senate to be the cooling saucer, so to speak. It's slower, it's more deliberate, it tends to be more moderate. And in impeachment, that's exactly what happened. The House rushed to judgment and impeached. The Senate refused to accept the articles of impeachment because it is a more deliberative and more moderate body. And, you know, the longer I am around, the more the wisdom of the Founding Fathers makes my hair stand on edge. They're just incredible.
Now, you supported censure of President Clinton, that he lied, but that the punishment should fit the crime. And that impeachment was far beyond what the punishment should be. You write in the book that the White House was unhappy with you. How is a message like that relayed, and what difference does it make to you when you know the White House is unhappy with you? What practically does that mean?
Well, when the White House is unhappy with you, it is usually conveyed not president to congressman or president to senator, but staff to staff. You know, the chief of staff in the White House will say, we don't like this. Now, as you know, as we say in the book, despite that, Hillary Clinton came up four times and campaigned for me and really helped me in that election. And then what difference does it make? Well, of course it's going to make differences. You know, if you need something at the White House at the same time, good for your state, an issue you care about, they may decide not to do it, although you'll never know, because they won't say we're doing this because we don't like what you're doing on impeachment. They'll just come up with a reason. One other thing that's interesting. The executive branch is so enormous that even if the inner circle in the White House is angry with something you've done, if you are friendly with a cabinet secretary and need something to help your state from that part, you'll probably get it anyway.
How much direct contact have you had with President Bush or Vice President Cheney?
Well, early on, I had more direct contact with them. And when they, I guess, found that I didn't agree with them and wouldn't play ball with them on a whole lot of issues, the contact pretty much stopped. And the president did call me after we won the 2006 elections to congratulate me. He was gracious. He said, I didn't think you'd pull the inside straight, but you did. But there is not much contact between at least this senator and the White House in the recent year or two. Maybe because I'm head of the DSCC, maybe because it's known that when I disagree with them, I state it pretty forthrightly. But for whatever reason, much less than there was even, I would say, in the first Bush administration when I was just a more junior House member.
In your new book, you talk a little bit about how you entered politics. And it's not like you intended to do it. You tried out for the freshman basketball team at Harvard, didn't make it, and so there went part of your community and social life that you were expecting. And then soon after that, somebody knocked on your door from the Eugene McCarthy campaign and asked you to campaign for him, and you did, and you love knocking on doors in New Hampshire. What did you love early on about politics?
It's sort of where ideas and people meet. At first, I thought I'd be an organic chemist. One night, I'm alone in the lab working on one of those long organic chemistry experiments. You know, it's 50 steps. You mess up 46. Step 46, you don't go to 45, back to 1. And finally, I got the experiment to work about 5 a.m. after working on it for 12 hours. And for a moment, I felt good. And then I realized, I don't like being alone here, even if there's a great intellectual fulfillment to making the experiment work. I like it with people. And so politics seemed to me to be the place where ideas and people met. And you have to remember, these were heady days. Here we were, a ragtag bunch of students and others, and we basically forced the most powerful man in the world, Lyndon Baines Johnson, to resign. It's always given me faith that the system, if you work hard enough and work through it, that you can get something done.
After going to law school, you neglected to take the job in a law firm that your parents were hoping you would take.
Yes.
And you say, half-kiddingly, I think, that when you decided to run for the New York Assembly, that your mother told all of her friends not to vote for you.
I wish it was half-kidding. She did.
She really laughs
at it now. Oh, yes. She was embarrassed. My mother, you know, she's such a good person, and thank God she's 78 and still healthy and still playing golf. And by the way, always prodding me, Chucky, you're not strong enough on this issue. You're not strong enough on that issue. But she was embarrassed when I ran for office. It was the Assembly. All they knew in Brooklyn was the Democratic machine. And I had this idealistic view. And their view, since my parents struggled, was, why don't I just go make money and have a nice living? This was sort of a quixotic adventure that they thought would hurt me. They've changed their minds, Lee, but it took a while.
One of the things that's often said about the Republican Party is that they really know how to maintain party discipline, and that that's been particularly true in the years of the Bush administration. And one of the, you know, common wisdom sayings about the Democrats is that there's always kind of arguing within the party about what direction to head in, and that that makes for less than a lot of forward momentum. Do you think that, how is party discipline within the party changing, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think we're more disciplined and more unified than we used to be. What I found in 2006, when I made some controversial decisions that we talked about before, is the number one goal people said is, why don't you win already? And now that we've won, it's making a difference already. The right-wing judges will not be appointed any longer to the bench. One of our big Democratic supporters was focused on Bolton. And in right before November, he said, I want to know how your 9 candidates you're supporting, these are non-incumbents, are viewed. I want them to take public positions against Bolton. And I said, I'm not going to ask them to do that. And after the election, of course, I still didn't know the position of Democrats, but the fact that we took power meant that Bolton wasn't going to be put in. And this gentleman, to his credit, called me up and said, I guess you were right.
Final question. You live in a house in Washington, and this isn't the home you have with your family. It's just like your place when you're in Washington on business during the week. And you share it with several other members of Congress. This house has become fairly famous. It was written up, I think it was in the New York Times. Here's what the article said. Think TV's Real World with a slovenly cast of Democratic power brokers. As a general rule, the abode is hardly fit for entertainment or even for a health inspector. It's used for convenience, sleeping, ditching stuff, and fast food consumption. I'm sure the house that you live in with your wife and children is much nicer than that. Do you have a nicer home only because you have a wife and children? Like, if you weren't married, would you always live like this house in Washington?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. But, you know, I've lived in that house in Washington. It's a little row house. I sleep downstairs on a bed that's sort of near the kitchen. But Washington can be a very lonely place for a senator or a congressman, millions of acquaintances, most of whom want something, very few friends. The nice thing about our house is that we're friends, and we sit around in our boxers at night and talk about the issues and watch sports and have a good time. And I guess neatness is not my strong suit. So I suppose that my house at home wouldn't be quite as neat as it is now if I lived alone. I think that's probably right.
Senator Schumer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you. I enjoyed it, Terry. Thanks a lot.
Senator Chuck Schumer has written a new book called Positively American.